Welcome to another episode of the Shut Up and Ride podcast. I'm already laughing because we've got a guest and I'm very excited. But we haven't got Benji, but I do have Simon. Mr. Grieve, how are you? Your hair is looking fabulous as always.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, no, I'm very good. Thank you very much. Just sad that Ben's not here.
I know, we do love him. You were even sending like love emojis to each other on WhatsApp the other day. I was like, wow, this is taking a turn.
He's a dude. He's a great guy.
We have to quickly mention our wonderful sponsors, Charles Owen, who I actually had lovely chats with the other day. They are always supporting this podcast, so a big shout out to them. We love them. And a very quick just shout out to all our audience. You send us amazing messages and lots of love all the time. But if I could ask anyone a favour, can you please share, like, follow this podcast? The messages are amazing, but if you could take it one step further and share the love, because the more people who listen to this, the more we can do it. So put some effort in. Come on, audience, share us. Anyway, enough of this. When I actually think I've definitely known longer than Ben, but I think I've interviewed you before I met him, Simon, but I don't think we were friends. I'm going to throw it out there. Bar one other person, and you'll know who I'm talking about, my favourite show jumper, Mr. Michael Duffy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a million for having us.
I did say there with a caveat, there's only one show jumper I love more than you. Do you know who that show jumper may be?
Shane Breen, is it?
Yes, it is. It is the one.
Good guess.
I know, he is good. And I think I met you through him, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, I did. Well, we would have met in Hickstead a few times and then on the global tour.
Yes.
Did you guys meet through like interviewing and stuff then?
Yes, kind of. And through Shane, I think. Because were you working for Shane back then?
Yeah, pretty many moons ago. I was working for Shane, a long time ago. That's 12 years ago now. I worked for Shane. And then as I said, we met on the global tour every week.
Yeah, so to give context, I worked on the Global Champions Tour between two making humans. So I made James, went on Global Champions Tour, then got pregnant and was pregnant in Monaco when me and Mr. Duffy and a few other riders, we had quite a fun night out and I didn't know I was pregnant with Delilah. And then I was pregnant in Paris and all I was trying to do for the whole of Paris, it was so hot and it was so awful, was try and not throw up. Because I was like so pregnant and I couldn't tell anyone. And so I spent all of Paris just trying not to chunder whilst interviewing riders. It was pretty traumatic.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. But I remember, so my first job on the Globals was Mexico. And was that your first ever Global Champions Tour as well, Mexico?
Yeah, first ever Global, yeah. Shane and I were on the team along with Dennis Lynch.
And my job at the end is to interview the rider. And it goes on Eurosport and you literally like in your ear, you've only got like three questions in and out, blah, blah, blah. And it was my first ever winner interview. Michael won. So I was like, yes, I know this guy. I could go and interview. We ran in, but no one had told us that the interview was going on the loudspeakers around the stadium. So I started.
No pressure.
No one knew. We knew it was going on TV live, but we didn't know it was going live around the stadium. And the Mexico stadium is amazing. It's huge. The crowds are nuts. I would say it's probably one of the best venues, wouldn't you say, Michael?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the best. And it's just, it's a bit old-fashioned in the way that it's a proper show. It's fun and everyone's trying and the crowd are all there, you know. So it's not your typical kind of la-di-da show, you know. It's a proper show.
And the audience are nuts. They're so passionate and also they're quite on it. And as I ask Michael, my first question, we suddenly hear it resonate around the stadium. And I just looked at him and he looked at me and we were like, what? And then I get shouted at my ear to keep talking, but we didn't know our voices were going to be on the stadium. And so it was just the most disconcerting thing to suddenly, and like, we were just like staring at each other in utter fear that everybody could hear what I thought was just this little live interview. So yeah, that was my first introduction to Global Champions Tour interviews. And it was with Mr. Michael Duffy. And you've won another Global since then, haven't you? Was that Miami?
Yeah, well, actually Mexico, we won the team class, the GCL. And then, I won the Grand Prix in Miami last
year. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. That is so cool.
It is very cool. It is very cool.
No, it's a cool old show that Miami. Actually, it's not happening this year. It's a pity. It's that's also a bit surreal when you're on the beach and you've got people out sunbathing and swimming and you're trying to do your 9 to 5, as they say.
Yeah, it does. It looks absolutely amazing. Proper cool experience.
I think when I was there working in Miami, it was a particularly horrible season in England, and Gemma Tattersall at Aventa was moaning about the weather, and I just sent her a shot of Miami and us on the beach, and I was just like, yeah, this is, you should take up show jumping, Gem. Like, quit.
Taking her advice since as well, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's doing bloody well. Right, Mr. Duffy, tell us a bit about you. I know a lot about you.
I want to go right back, because like we're talking about going for championships tours and like you doing so brilliantly and being amazing. But where did it all start? Like, I'm assuming in Ireland.
Yeah, well, actually, sure. Like, we're quite a big horse family from home. Like, my grandfather was a course builder, and he built all over the world. He was, you know, he built Spruce Meadows and Wellington to, you know, Dublin, Olympia. He went as far as, I think it was the Royal Sydney Horse Show as a course builder. And my dad rode as well. So he had a good career. Like, he rode, you know, at the top level when he was younger. And then they had a big riding school at home as well. Started with lessons, and it was always a big, big horse family. There was always horses around. My uncle rode, so he still rides. His kid is riding, Isabel. My sisters rode. They gave up pretty soon, but they all rode when I was a kid.
Because with these like big families that like that, equestrian families, I often kind of think, do the kids feel pressurized into riding because they have to? And not have to, but like, did you feel pressure to start riding, or was it something that you just naturally wanted to do?
No, I always. Well, I had a pony when I was a kid, a little kind of a Palomino, my first pony. I forget his name now, actually. And I got a couple of falls off him. I was maybe 6 or 7, and that was enough for me then. I stopped for a couple of years. I was playing rugby and football and hurling and whatever, you know, in school and all that. And then my dad was going to his show, a local show, I think it was Headford Gymkhana one day. He had 20, 25 horses in work all the time. And I said to him, I was maybe 8 or 9 or something. And I said, so you're going to the show tomorrow? He's like, yeah, we're going to the show. I says, I'll go with you. And he says, oh, that's good. You're going to come to watch. I says, no. I'll go and ride at the show. He's like,
you
haven't ridden and you don't have a pony. So down to the tech shop, we bought the boots and the chaps and the jodhpurs and borrowed a pony off a friend of ours. Went in, eliminated at the first fence. And then that was it. But I'm kind of hooked then again.
But you obviously then like got really, really into it, because I saw something on your Instagram or something like that saying about when you were a kid you had like 18 ponies at a show in one day or something crazy like that. You obviously did a lot with the ponies.
Yeah, well, that's when my dad was unreal. Like, he wouldn't have actually been that old. Like, you know, he'd have been, I don't know, early 40 or early 40s. And,
I'm glad you said not that old then, Michael Duffy, because I'm in my early 40s and so is Simon. So you could have got a slap through the internet.
Saying all the right things, so it's all good.
And literally one winter, it went from 20, 25 horses in the yard and one or two ponies to, you know, 20 ponies and one or two horses. You know, he basically, you know, stepped back from his from what he was doing and went all into me, basically. And yeah, as I said, like, I did pony Europeans, you know, I did a lot. I think I did my first international, I don't know, 13 or something like that, with a good stallion pony, Silver Shadow. And then I got a very good pony called Silog Darkie. And then we went to the Europeans and had, you know, silver medal and all that. And yeah. And even he had a very good Grand Prix horse called Dusky Clover. And when I was 12, he gave him to me for the Children on Horses.
Wow.
So, you know what I mean? Like,
that's pretty,
you know, he basically, I wouldn't say he stopped, but he put his career kind of, well, he did basically stop, I suppose. And yeah, and then just put it all into me.
And did you find when you, obviously, like the changeover from ponies to horses, like some people find that quite difficult. Was it quite natural for you? Obviously, you were doing children on the horses anyway.
I remember the pony European team when I was 15. I was the smallest of all the girls by like a foot. You know, I was, when I went to Shane Breen's, and Shane's not exactly a giant, my stirrups were shorter than his. and then around you know 1920, I started to grow really.
Shot up.
Yeah, I don't know why. I was late bloomer, I suppose. But I'd be 6 foot now, but I was always tiny. But yeah, no, with the ponies and the horses, again, I was doing it from when I was 12. Like, I remember I did a pony, I was second in the pony Grand Prix and the junior Grand Prix in the Rotorham when I was 15 or something. So it wasn't that difficult when I was always doing it. But I can see how, you know, if you look at a lot of them good kids, especially my generation now, well, we're not kids, but, you know, they were all on horses early, you know. And the ponies are great too, but I think you have to, you know, I think it's good to get on the horses early.
Did you have to sell? Oh, sorry, Simon. I was just saying, when you were a kid, because when I trained in Ireland, I worked in Ireland, I used to sell at Gore's Bridge. And there was always like a couple of lads that would come and be selling the ponies and the smaller horses. And they were just incredible jockeys. And I would always be like, I'm not buying one of them because I know how good those kids are. And I know those horses probably are not as easy as those kids are making them. Did you have to do that? Did you have to like sell as well? Or were you able to have the luxury of keeping any good ones?
No, we always had to sell. People used to bring ponies to the show and you'd get your 50 quid to ride them at the show. Like, you wouldn't get to ride them at home. You just showed them and jumped them for them. And we always sold. I actually remember, I'd say it was one of the first rows I had with my dad. My 12-2 pony was he was a right cheeky.
You can swear on this podcast, it's all right.
But he wasn't simple though. He was quite naughty. And I won the Grand Prix in Mill Street on him. And we got a very good offer for someone to buy him. And I begged him to sell him. But Aisling, my younger sister, she's kind of 14 or 15 months younger than me. She said, oh, I want to ride him. And I remember saying to my dad, well, if we can sell him, we can buy her too, you know. And no, that's where he was unreal. He said, no, you had your chance. Now she can have hers. And he didn't work for her either, but she won't mind me saying. But got her fingers burnt. But no, we always were sold. We always had to sell, basically. Still to this day, still have to sell them. It's second nature. It was just always how it was. And we took liveries and we used to do everything to.
So did you then move, obviously you were based at home, and then did you move to the Breens from there or...
Yeah, so I had a very good, like, young career. Like, at 17, I was senior national champion and I got to ride the internationals in Dublin and all that. And
the youngest ever senior national champion, weren't you?
Yeah, that was 2012, I think.
And that says a lot coming from the kind of the heritage that Ireland has to be the youngest ever senior national champion. That sounds like an oxymoron, but it's pretty impressive. Because you've got the likes of Bertram Allen in your age group, haven't you? Kind of those guys all coming through.
Yeah, I know. And it was a very good year that year. I remember like Dermot Lennon was there. He had a horse called Hallmark Elite that was double clear in Aachen that year. And, you know, there was loads. Pacino. There was Clem McMahon's horse. There was great horses around that time, you know. So it was, I definitely wasn't favourite going into it. But it came off and it was great. And, you know, and like, we're from the west of Ireland, like the most westernly point in Europe. You couldn't get further away for, you know, in show jumping terms or in sporting terms. And I was always very driven and keen and wanted to go to the top. And I remember it was difficult for my father as well. Like, because then I don't even think I was 18 or I was just close to it anyway, if I was. Or maybe I was, yeah, whatever, I was 17, 18. You know, with the home place, with the yard at home, there was horses in livery, there was owners, there was everything. And
was I was going to say, you must have been the biggest part of the business, and then you leave this massive void.
I kind of had to force it through, really. You know what I mean? I wanted to, and they were very supportive. They were obviously they knew well, but you know, it was a stage where either you stay at home and you try and do it from there or you move on. And I must say, Ireland is a very different place now. You know, it's there's a lot of good shows and centres and there's a lot more horses and people around like Kean and Greg Broderick and all these guys are still based at home, you know, and they're running big businesses. But at the time, there wasn't the same opportunities and I was, just very, very keen to get going. And I had a few different offers. Ultimately, I remember my parents saying to me, that's why they liked Shane, because he did the same, you know, he kind of had the same background as me and came up a bit the same way and thought it would be a good fit. We're still best mates to this day.
He's such a ledge. Yeah. I always say, especially now I'm working at Thunderbird in Langley and we get a lot of the Irish coming over here in Canada. We've just had Daniel Coyle, Connor Swale, like so many of them. But I do think that Shane is just one of the most brilliant horsemen in the world. And I'd say it to his face as well. But I just think there's something about him that is just... Can you put your finger on it? Or do you disagree?
No, absolutely. Listen, sure, he's brilliant. But again, the same old thing. Like, he had the same upbringing. He was, you know, it was he never had the big fancy young rider horse. Or, you know what I mean? Like, it was... Make the most of what you have, and if you're good enough, and ultimately learning to ride all different kinds of horses, and I suppose doing it that way is, I think, what makes so many good Irish riders.
Yeah, there's something like 12 Irish riders in the top 100.
There was 24 Irish riders competed at a 5-star show 2 weekends ago.
Jesus.
Different shows, obviously. There was Rome. I was in Cannes. There was, I think, one over there in America somewhere, and yeah, 24 different riders at 5-star shows.
So does that, like, is that not a bit annoying as well? Because I always think it must be fucking difficult to get on an Irish team, because it's not like there's just a couple of you that are competing and then some of you are good. Like, I mean, like, look at Daniel Coyle and Keane and Shane, like,
that's
and yourself. They're bloody amazing. Like, is it very, very competitive? Like, is it very hard?
It's unbelievably competitive. But ultimately, there's one thing getting on a team, and then there's another thing being on a winning team.
Yeah.
I've also no interest in being there and finishing fourth and jumping 4-4. That happens, don't get me wrong. You don't jump clear every week. But no, I think ultimately, if you can get on that team, you have a very, very strong chance. Yeah, what's better? As I said, it's one thing getting the T-shirt and saying you were there, and another thing bringing home some silverware, you know?
What would you rather be on, Olympic medal winning team or win the Aga Khan?
Yeah, the Olympics is the pinnacle of our sport, isn't it? But listen, there's no reason. I'd like to do both if I could.
I was going to say, you wanted to do both.
Yeah, but no, I've ridden the Aga Khan. We were second 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable, you know, Dublin Horse Show. It is, and like that's where as a kid, you know, everyone remotely related to horses. There's farmers who breed one horse. They take their week's holiday at Dublin Horse Show for the week. So everyone, you grow up, you know, leaning over the rail and watching the warm-up, all these, you know, superstars and all those other guys. And so that's ultimately what drives you on. So, but yeah, that is unreal. But the Olympics is the pinnacle of the sport.
I like the way you had to think about it, though. Like, that's still not a definite answer. There still wasn't a yes or no to either. Like, it is like, it's like for Simon saying, which would you rather win, badminton or a gold medal? Do you know what I mean? Which would you rather win, badminton or a gold medal?
Me?
Yeah.
I think I would rather win badminton.
There you go. But to the outside world, who don't necessarily...
If I was then to go to, like, I don't know, a party where no one was horsey, and they said, oh, I won badminton horse trials, they'd be like, great, well done, what is that? And if I said I'm an Olympic champion, I want a gold medal at the Olympics, they'd be like, oh wow, god, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? But I don't know, just from the, I just think to win badminton is, it's just, it would be unbelievable to do that.
No. And I think that's the same with the Aga Khan and the Olympics. That's the same in show jumping, isn't it? Like, a lot of people can know all about show jumping and never have heard of the Dublin Horse Show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You see, I bet you see that a lot more in the States now or in Canada, you know. It's a different world, isn't it? You know, they wouldn't have heard of a lot of the good European riders and vice versa.
This exact thing happened to me. So I was invited to work at a Washington International Horse Show. Okay. And before I went, I was chatting to one of the guys who I was meant to be working with, who does a lot of the circuits and does thermal and all these places. And he was like, yeah, some of the best in the world will be at Washington, some of the best in the world, in an American accent, which I won't try and do. Simon does the accents, not me. And I was like, oh, who's going to be there? And I was like Scott Brash or like Marcus Enning, like the people. I started reeling off names of people I thought were the best in the world. Didn't know a single rider that I named. I was like, what? Like, couldn't name, like, had not heard of any of the European riders that I'd named. I was like, it's not really the best in the world. It might be some of the best in America. But, like, it was just, it really opened my eyes to how little I think our big riders are not known across here, which is disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I say, like, you'd often see it in the World Cup finals. There's always, you know, three or four people, even from California or that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, have heard of. But, yeah, it's just how it is. Different sides of the world, and ultimately, you know, I suppose that's the beauty of it too. You get a level playing field.
Yeah. Well, you have a problem with your name. I was chatting to Daniel Coyle the other day because he was over here and he was like, oh, so who do you know of the Irish team? And I was like, oh, I know Shane and Trev and Michael Duffy. And he went, which one? Because there are a few show jumping Michael Duffys.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't mind with Michael. He had to become Michael G. Duffy to differentiate. But like we're from the same area. Like our families were very close growing up, and Sharice, we grew up together, ponies. And I remember when we were younger, I used to always get his fines in the post, and he used to always get my prize money. It was gas the way it always worked out.
Because when we were in Monaco, you get invited to quite some fun stuff. Don't worry, I won't go too far with this story, Mr. Duffy. But we got invited onto a super yacht. Now, I am not from a wealthy background, and I certainly do not fit in with the Jen Gates and the Springsteens of the world. So I'm on this super yacht. Like, I have no idea who to talk to. I have no, like, Jessica Curtin saw me and came over. She was like, you're right, Jenny, you're looking very lost. I was like, I don't know who to talk to. And then the Irish boys turned up, and I just got a message, like, we're down on the other deck. And I was like, thank God. Okay. Like, however many of these tours you do, you guys, like, it was both Duffy's. I think of Shane, wasn't it? Because he won in Monaco, yeah, didn't he, that year? And then I got told off as well for that. But I was like, thank God, because however much you guys have been on this tour for however long, you're still boys down the pub, Irish boys. Like, you haven't changed. You haven't got your airs and graces about you. Well, you might have done now. This was a few years ago. You might now be a total dickhead.
I'd like to think not anyway. But no, if you listen, you never forget where you come from ultimately. We've all had good groundings anyway, good roots put down, and sure.
When you first started doing shows like that, it's obviously like really like there's pressure and it's quite intimidating. Do you approach these things differently now to how you did at the beginning, or do you feel like you're a lot more relaxed about it now, or because you've got more experience of it?
To be honest, I've always been quite steady. You know, I never really get too up or down. And I suppose in this game, you get a lot more downs than ups. So you get you get used to losing a lot more than you win. But no, I've always been quite relaxed. And listen, I remember the first show, Mexico City. You were definitely on your game, and the first Nations Cup, all that malarkey. You know, you'd be nervous or whatever. But listen, at the end of the day, When you're riding a horse, it's the same wherever you're riding them. You know what I mean? Like, as long as you know them and you know what you're doing, then, you know, you just got to tune all the rest out and, yeah, just get on with it.
Yeah, so you've obviously got, like, the right kind of, like, mentality to be able to deal with that kind of stuff, because most of us would be stressing about going to that for the first time. I know Jenny would be.
I'd chip my pants. That's why I talk about it, so I don't do it.
But you were talking about how, like, the downs outweigh the ups. What has been your most kind of, like, sorry, this is an awful question to ask. What's been the kind of worst moment for you in your career so far?
The worst one?
That's a great question. Yeah, how shit has it been?
What have you had to come back from?
I was eliminated two rounds of the Nations Cup in Wellington this year. That wasn't a very high moment. I suppose I wouldn't really remember that many of the rounds, you know, as in bad results or whatever, you'll have them. But I remember I lost a couple of horses along the way. I remember when I was young, I was 21, I had a good horse called Bel Canto. Mm. And I did my first Super League Cup in La Bolle on him. And I had him to sell. I was fully aware he was going to be sold. And but I remember when he was sold, I took up gardening for 10 days. Depression and yeah. You're not getting another one. And then 2 weeks later, top contender. Or whatever, maybe it was a month later or 2 months later, came into the yard and you're off again, you know. So yeah, and as I said, I've had good horses along the way that have been sold or injured, and that would be more, you know, I'd remember that more so than actually having two down or
yeah.
That kind of stuff. I should have won Mexico Grand Prix actually the next year. I remember that on a 9-year-old horse. He'd the second last fence down the jump off. Yeah, that I do remember.
Yeah. Just going to rub that one in. I think show jumpers get a... obviously, I've worked with a lot of show jumpers, so I can see it from both sides. But I think when we were kids, me and Simon, not you so much, I think I'm like 12 years... You're 31 now? 30?
Yeah, 30, yeah.
30. Oh, God. Congratulations on turning 30. Well done. Big one. Still so young. But when we were growing up, like, I had pictures of Milton on my wall. Like, and I even think, like, back then, like, Arco and these horses stayed with their riders for a long time and you could really follow them. Whereas now it does feel like the Irish riders and the English riders just to compete abroad. We never see them. They're always on a different bloody horse. So I feel like that kind of the show jumpers aren't able to show like that love of the horse, like maybe an eventer or a dressage rider.
Do you
or
think
something.
That's because the business has taken over more now than...
Yeah, like, do you think that, like, that is quite hard, like, hearing you say that your down points have been having to sell a horse and you didn't ride for 10 days? I think a lot of people would be quite shocked at that, because I think from the outside it does look more business-like now, show jumping. Like, but I'm guessing that's not, because what, how, like, are you very passionate about each horse that comes through your barn and the love of it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. For sure, it's gone very commercial, you know. It's so expensive to keep horses now. I mean, I don't know how many horses I have. I've got plenty, like, we've just shy of 100 horses now between the young ones and the mares and older ones and everything. So that's also bills. But also I compete probably 40, 44 shows a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're competing 3 out of 4 weeks or 4 out of 5 weeks. So you're like, I did, I was just in Cannes, Saint-Tropez. I'm going to a national show tomorrow. Basically, I compete every weekend. You don't get to, you know, that's the one thing about the eventers or dressage horses. They actually don't come out as much. So there probably is a bit more riding on your performance too, you know. I have a bad day. I didn't have a great day last Saturday in the Grand Prix in Saint-Tropez, but I'm back in Monaco in 10 days, you know. You don't really have time to dwell good or bad. It's just so commercial now. Like, you know, years ago, like, I used to love growing up watching the VHSs in the old tapes in my grandfather's house. And actually during COVID, we went and pulled down a pile more and, you know, and you'd watch the pairs relay in Olympia or the fancy dress, and everyone had a good speed horse. A good speed horse would win money now, you know. Nowadays, people would produce an 8-year-old around that class to make it, you know, get the experience on it to make it probably more valuable and to ultimately sell it, you know. So a little bit of that showmanship has kind of, you know, died out a little bit, but there is still good shows. Like, as I say, we were mentioning Dublin earlier. Like, one of the hardest classes to win is the bloody 145 the first day. You've got, you know, so many lads trying, you know, the Irish trying to win it. And I'm sure it's the same for the Germans in Aachen and all that. But it is definitely, you know, the sport has changed, you know, dramatically. Even in you know, I did my first 5-star in Dublin, 12 or 13 years ago. And even since then, it's changed, you know, massively.
Do you get time to just... like, love it? When was the last time you went head hopping?
Actually, Shane and I took off. I did Windsor. When is that?
A couple of weeks ago.
May, whatever. Yeah, a month, 6 weeks ago. I went over a day early and stayed in Hickstead for the night and rode them in Hickstead in the morning before they went in. And Shane and I tacked up Cantano and he was on Cato Boy and we took off over to the farm and checked the foals and we were gone for an hour and a half, the two of us, before we came back.
I've been head hopping with Shane Breen. It's terrifying.
Yeah, but that's where the hunting comes out in you again.
Yes, I've hunted in Ireland. One of the most terrifying experiences of my life. Like, absolutely terrifying. Obviously, we weren't hunting actual things because it was banned by then. But yeah, I remember we turned up. We had the horses tacked up. They're ready to go. And we were like, where the fuck is everyone? We got to the meet and I was like, where is everyone? And there was all the lorries. And then we saw two lads either side. I'm going to do a terrible Irish accent. I apologise now. Either side of this hole in the hedge. And they were like, over here. Lash out, will ya? I tell you, we're on this side. And I was like, all right. So we would get to this hedge. And as I start to ride through the gap in the hedge, these two guys jump out with sticks and go, ah, and chase us. Because on the other side of this hedge was a ditch. And the meat was on the other side of the ditch. And apparently everyone was stopping and no one was getting over the ditch and getting a run up at it. So they just thought, fuck it, we'll take them by surprise and chase them with bushes to get them over.
It worked, didn't it?
It bloody did, yes.
That was very kind of them.
Yeah, I fell off 3 times that day and got laughed at every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's not simple. It's not for the faint-hearted.
No, it's a wonder I'm alive. So I remember you're a bit of a bit like Simon. Simon's a bit of an eventing geek. Like, I would say
in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s.
His knowledge is very limited to around the 1994, 96 era. But you, having done filming with you and masterclasses with you, and then obviously I've known you for many years now, you are a bit of a show jumping geek, aren't you? Like, you watch how other riders ride and go. And I remember you explaining to me why Marcus Enning is so good at a turn back. And I watched Marcus Enning in a totally different light after that. I've always thought he was amazing, best rider in the world. But it was your detail about his turn backs. I was like, fucking hell, never thought of it like that. But I also remember you saying, like, how weight-wise Scott Brash was so skinny, and like, you were like, I need to get my weight down, I need to be like Scott. And like, how is your kind of pressure, do you put a lot of pressure on yourself to be like these riders that you follow and watch? And like, are you quite hard on yourself?
I sure would be. It'd be deep enough in lots of ways, you know. But if you're not, like, I never for like, not for a second do I have to think about, you know, watching, or it's just you're either obsessed with something or you're not, you know. And it's like, how do you beat these guys? You know what I mean? They're so good, and ultimately you can't look at one person and say I want to be like him, because you know you just can't. You have to, you know, pick the strongest bits. And I always found myself in my own career, it's what you're probably lacking at the time. You're kind of notice more on certain people. Like, even now for me, I know Ben Mayer is number two in the world, but you know, I think for his whole setup, he's number one. I mean, with his owners, and he keeps finding all these good horses. It's so hard to find these horses now. As I said, the market is so strong. You know, the to buy a 10, 11-year-old ready made to go that in 3 months you can do a Grand Prix is, you know, the figures are very, very high. So you know, you look at someone like him, he's always got a good client, he's never leaves the top 5, 6, 8 in the world, he's always got another horse, you know. And then the riding side of it, I don't even need to speak about. Sure, he's brilliant, you know. And then you've got the flip side, like Scott, to be fair to him, had to bite his lip for a couple of years there. You could say 21, 22, 23, he was maybe a bit quieter than he normally would be. And he's after winning, I don't know, 3 or 4 Grand Prix this year again. Yeah. You know, he's back with a bang. He's after winning 2 or 3 on the trot, 2nd in Den Bosch. But, you know, his resilience, it's another thing to admire by him. He doesn't, like, Scott wouldn't waver on his plan or what he's doing. You know, he's, you know, supremely focused. Maybe that's one thing sometimes I'm a bit, you know, if it's not going your way, you'll try and change too much and try and go again. But, yeah, and as I say, like, the level of detail now, well, I suppose I think our sport was also a bit lacking in those things, you know. And you know, if you watched, as you said, John and Milton in that era, there was literally 20% the amount of professionals or good riders that there are now. You know, there's other sides of the world, as you say, that we don't even know about. So we're not really breeding that many more horses, but we've got, you know, 200 more riders that more. Whatever, however many hundred more riders that need that horse. So you need to grab it with both hands anyway, that's for sure.
I love that. You picked out bits like people wouldn't know that were obvious. Like, someone, mere mortals would go, Scott's position's really good. But I like the way you're like, no, his resilience, and like picking out bits of riders that you wouldn't necessarily think.
Yeah, and like for me, Daniel Deusser, okay, he's a little bit taller than me, but like, you'd watch him, and him I can relate to, because, you know, we're of a similar size, where Scott is a good bit smaller. So, you know, you can pick out the line. As I said, Marcus Enning's also not that tall, but, you know, the way he can manipulate the line of the course is unbelievable. And his hands, the way he, such a light touch for, you know, he doesn't need to, you know, be as physically as strong as, you know, a great big fella, because his technique is so good, you know. But, you know, if you can just try and piece together all the bits that suit, but then ultimately you have to remember it's you that's on the horse, and you have to try and make it fit to you as well.
You don't see as much now with your kind of generation coming through and younger than you. Do you remember, like, the extravagant throwing oneself over a fence? I'm going to use Bosty as an example, Roger Yves Bost. His, like, exuberant style over a fence, and his lower leg comes up round his ass somewhere and it works. And trust me, I've seen Bosty win many, many a class. But I feel like that you don't see that style of riding anymore. Everyone seems to have gone more of the route of... I even said it to Daniel Coyle, actually, the other day. Daniel, I was like, because I haven't seen Daniel ride in the flesh for years, literally years. I haven't seen him for probably 5 or 6 years. And I said to him, I was like, Daniel, has your riding style changed a bit? Like, you seem very much more chilled and composed and calm. And he was like, interesting you said that, Jenny. You're the second person who said that to me today. And he's been training with Gerard Doubledam. And he was like, yeah, he's taught me to be more calm and patient and different with his upper body and things like that. But would you, am I completely deluded in this? Or would you say that?
You're just making me think of Annette Lewis now.
Annette Lewis, was she the one who used to go in the air like about a foot?
Yeah, she literally used to like come completely off the saddle and her legs like went straight up in the air.
But I don't feel like you see that as much now with your kind of you and younger. I feel like you all look very... I'm going to say Ben Mayer would have kind of led the way with, like, he's more eye age. Am I deluded or would you say that's right?
No, I remember when I was younger, like, okay, Ireland was a little bit backward in other countries compared to, but if you had a trainer, it was nearly, what do you need a trainer for? You know what I mean? When I was in ponies or that. And nowadays, like, the whole mentality has changed that, you know, the access to, like, I remember when I started going to pony shows, for example, there was one or two trainers there and everyone else was there with their mum and dad. Now you go to those shows, you're tripping over trainers. There's two trainers for every kid, you know what I mean? So I would say, the level of you know, work and knowledge has been drilled into them from the start. Whereas, you know, if you were to ask Shane Breen about his start, you know, it was his dad was a bank manager. You know, he used to hunt on the weekends and then Shane went show jumping, you know, so there wasn't the same, you know, you kind of learnt by trial and error, I suppose. But I think just that the whole standard of everything is, you know, tenfold. You know, when you see some of these kids now, you know, like I remember if you rode a 5-star show when you were 20 or 21, you were very, very young. You know, nowadays, you're nearly, if you're not riding a 5-star, but then there's, you know, that's not true. Dermot Lennon, he was world champion at 30 or 32 and he only rode his First Nations Cup a year or two before that. But there's just so many kids, you know, with access to horses and good help nowadays.
Oh, it's terrifying.
That wasn't there before, you know.
If that's the standard at 21, like, good luck for you, you're 30. You're going to be old soon, Michael.
Yeah, honestly, I used to be the young rider. I was always in my head the young rider, and now I haven't been the oldest one yet. I've always had someone just a little older than me. But there's you know, you look at your Mikey Penders and these fellas, you know what I mean? Bertram is a year younger than me, but there's so many, you know. Look at Harry Charles, his bloody team gold medal from the Olympics at, I don't know what age is he? Is he 26, 25, 27?
Yeah.
Something like that. You know, most people don't get to an Olympics. You know, well, at all, but until they're later in life, let alone a gold medal.
I know. And that was
Michael,
nuts.
So who's your trainer then? Who's your main coach?
Well, as I said, when I was younger, my father would have started off, and then I worked for Shane. But I'd work a lot with Helena now.
Right. Okay.
But ultimately, I'd be like last week. You'd be walking the course, and you can bounce ideas off everyone. You know.
That's crazy, though, I do think. I always think that, like, obviously I'm always walking the courses now because I commentate on the show jumping. I don't just stand there with a microphone anymore now. I actually talk about you lot. Got some grief off some of the boys at the weekend. It's always the Irish who are pretty happy to share their opinion on what you said about them.
Funny that.
Yeah. And then, yeah, but I find that nuts that you're all giving each other advice. You're competing against each other.
Yeah, like so I train Zoe Conter now quite a bit. And we were 21st and 22nd to go in the Grand Prix there in Saint-Tropez. So, you know, you're walking the course with two hats on. You're thinking, right, Cantano jumps a little to the right and, you know, he does this and he does that. And then Zoe's horse does this and does that. So you're kind of having to, I'll walk a line and go, right, that's 7 for me on the outside, slow it down. But you can come on the inside, get up the inside track, you know, blah, blah, blah. And actually that also is because I've done a lot of, you know, teaching and coaching since I was young. But that also gives you another, you know, it keeps you on your toes. It keeps you thinking, you know, you'd be sitting in the house having a cup of tea in the evening and you'll go, I wonder what that bridle will do on Zoe's horse or Sloan's mare or my own, or, you know what I mean? And I need to jump him a bit more at home, or I need to jump him a bit less, or whatever it may be. But it definitely keeps you on your toes, you know, as well as everything else.
I found that with any coaching that I've done, it makes me think so much more about what I'm doing myself. Randomly, and I find it really helpful helping other people. Like, it helps me with my writing too.
Well, you can't preach and then not practice, can you? So, like, when you're telling them to,
I can
get going.
Those who can do, those who can't get a microphone and talk about it. Hilarious. So I was walking the Nations Cup Grand Prix course at the weekend, a couple of weekends ago, and I'm walking the final line, and Patricio Pascal, who's a Mexican rider, who is brilliant. He makes me laugh constantly. The man's hilarious. And he came out, and I think the final line was seven, and I was like, that's seven. I can't see anything else other than seven. And he came out, and he was like, yeah, I'm definitely doing eight there. And I was like, what the fuck? How are you getting an eight in there? So I walked it again. I was like, well, yeah, there probably is, but I don't think anyone would do that. So I was standing there looking at this line, and Daniel Coyle came over, and I was like, what'd you get? And he was like, seven. Should I have got anything else? I was like, you've been to an Olympics. Don't ask me for advice. And how are you, like, the fact that he was even questioning what I had walked, it was just like, it was just made me laugh. The fact that all you show jumpers, you like, you think you've walked a line, but yet someone will find a different option, which will make someone else question it, which will make someone else question it.
Well, doctors differ and patients die, isn't that it? So like, you know, there's different horses, and, you know, as I say, some have a bigger step, some have a smaller. Some jump one way. And I always think you should never, yes, you have to have a plan, and you have to be, you know, very, very certain of what you're doing. But you can't be afraid of plan B either, you know. Things happen in a course, and you have to react as well, you know. And that's kind of hard to train, but you have to be, you know, able to, yeah, to call it, I suppose, don't you?
I have this argument with Ben, who has not managed to join us on this podcast today, about natural talent versus kind of luck, skill, money. And he doesn't believe in natural ability. He thinks that anyone can be a good rider and learn to do what he, I don't know if you follow him on social media or anything, but what he does with horses is just phenomenal. What you two do with horses is phenomenal. And I don't believe that everybody can do it, be a natural horseman. Especially, like, again, we talk about Shane all the time. The man is a natural horseman. You yourself, I've seen you ride. You are a brilliant horseman. What's your take on it? Do you think anyone can learn, or do you think you have to be born with this kind of way with a horse?
No, I think you can learn anything, you know. To make it to the very, very top is very, very tough. You have to be very committed and all that. And sometimes you'd often find a lot of natural riders who find it very easy, you know. And then when the screw gets tightened at the end and it's top level, because ultimately that just doesn't happen. But some of them fall away a little easier than someone who maybe wasn't naturally as talented and actually had to, you know, work and do the last little bit. You know, some of them find it actually they're the better men in those tougher moments, you know. So, you know, listen, ultimately I think you can learn it. There's loads of examples of, you know, people who weren't maybe the most best in ponies or the best in young riders. Like Richie Vogel now, I don't think he ever went to a young rider championships. But what is he, six in the world or seven in the world and winning Grand Prix left, right and centre. So he was number six or seven jockey in beer bombs at one stage, you know, behind Kukuk, Weissout, Marco Kutcher, all them. So I think you can. It's not simple, but yeah, listen, if you're born with talent, it's easier. But you also have to have the work ethic to back it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's as you say, mentally, it's very, very tough. You're every week on a plane, new show, knocking jumps, dust yourself down, get back up and go again, you know. It is, you have to be relentless. As Elena always says, if you rest, you rust. So you have to keep going.
Have you ever found it, like, we talk quite a lot about mental health, and I know there's a great charity in the UK now called Riders Minds, which they've messaged me actually say to give them a shout out. Have you ever struggled mentally? I know, Simon, you've had some tough times, and we know a lot of people who've had tough times, especially riders, because there is a kind of element to riders, isn't there, where it is just get on with it. Like you can't, like, amount of times I've hurt myself and I'm like, no, I must get back on the horse. Can't show weakness. I feel like that is a thing. Have you ever found it hard? If you don't mind me asking.
You know, listen, there's loads of times you're thinking, bloody hell, I wish I was here or there or doing this or that. But the very, very good lads, you know, it's not that they don't show weakness, but they just keep going, don't they? You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, this game. And you can look at John Whittaker. I don't want to say how old he is because I'll get it wrong, but he's just shy of 70, I suppose. You know what I mean? He must be 67 or 8. So he was probably in whatever, late 20s when I was born, you know. So he'd already had a full career by the time You know, as I said, I was born, so you can ride forever. I think ultimately when you enjoy working with horses, like it's not a 9-to-5 visitor. There's not a, you know, there's always something to do. Horses have to be fed and mucked out and worked every day. So as long as you can accept that, and as long as you want to do that, you'll keep going, basically. Like I remember I was young when I top contender and I got into Geneva, which is a Rolex prestigious, you know, once in a lifetime show. And the week before in Kiso, at a 2-star, I cracked 2 ribs. Horse fell over, and so I had 2 cracked ribs. So I went into John Harris in Epsom, and he put this, like, wrapped me up, and here's 4 paracetamol, and you get on with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's because it was Geneva, and I had a good horse at the time, and it's like everything. When you're on your game like that, you don't really feel pain. But I remember in Miami when I won there. I don't mind saying it because I was blubbering, but I lost my best friend, Jack Dodd, in a car crash. It was actually about 5 or 6 years. Yeah, it was 7 years a month ago. So that was 6 years.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, when I win my first 5-star Grand Prix, I'll dedicate it to him. Not thinking it was going to be 6 years before it came. And then when they were doing the interview, I don't cry. I couldn't tell you the last time I cried. I started blubbering, you know. Like, obviously, you know, that was brewing away inside. I didn't even know myself. But that was obviously bubbling away for a while, you know.
Because that's the one thing that I kind of, like, obviously, I don't know you, Michael, at all. This is the only time I've seen you. But, like, you seem very level. Like, you seem like, you know, it would take quite a lot to flummox you. Or, like, that seems to be one of your biggest strengths, is that you're consistent all the way through. And that's probably why you've been so successful. And obviously, like, driven and hardworking.
Yeah, but as I say, you have to just keep going. There's always another. And your mindset is very, very important, you know. Like a lot of the sports psychologists, some people think it's pants and some people swear by it, you know. But ultimately, they all come back to the same thing. It's about, you know, what you put out, you get back. And if you're always, you know, thinking the right way, and you know, some people have to work harder to do that than others, you know. But it's all about, you know, positive and keep moving forward, basically.
And isn't it amazing? I don't know whether you've had this, but, like, you know, when you start winning, you start winning. And there's, like, this kind of, like, you kind of feel like everything you touch goes to gold. And it's amazing. And then when something goes wrong, and then all of a sudden everything starts to fall apart. It's like, that seems to me how, like, equestrian sport goes. Like, you're either on an up or you're on a down. There's not much in between.
No, and as I say, like, you know, everyone, you know, that's why, look at Brash now, for example. Like, that's where you'd have to take your hat off to him again. As I said, he wasn't like he was that bad for the few years, but when you're used to him winning, I think that was his 15th global 5-star, just global win. But when he won probably 12 of them so, you know, quickly and together, and then he didn't win one for 3 or 4 years, you know, it feels like, you know, he's a victim of his own success in a way, but it nearly felt quiet. But then to come back and to go. And, like, people love a comeback story, like, you know, Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods or any of them lads, you know, those guys that can get maybe reason for losing trust. But, when they come back like that, you know, that's a sign of a great athlete, basically.
So what would be your biggest kind of, you've done a lot of really great things, you've won some great things. What would be your biggest ambition now, do you think?
Yeah, well, I got to like 58 or something in the world. Ultimately, you know, you have to be realistic. I'd love to obviously get that better, but, you know, you need a squad of horses for that, and you need to be able to pick your shows. So when I do a lot of the younger ones and a lot of training, that's probably not going to get a whole lot higher. I've dropped a bit since then, but so basically get back up a bit closer. Top 30 would be a goal, but I would be working back, always back from Europeans, you know, Olympics, Europeans, World Games. You know, you want to win, you know, Grand Prix along the way, for sure. There's loads of good ones. There's Aachen down the road there and Dublin, all those things. But I think ultimately, I think, you know, at the end of your career, people look back at championships and go, you know, he was, you know, look at your own Dubeldam or Rodrigo Pessoa. They have a full set, you know what I mean? I think ultimately that's what people will remember in 20, 40, 60 years.
Well, look at Nick. Of all the things that Nick Skelton won, it was that final gold medal on Big Star.
They're making movies about him now.
Yeah, I know, right?
Was at Melton Mowbray Cinema last night.
Yeah.
That's all right. They'll be making movies about you, Michael. If you're going on this on show jumping career length, you've still got all of your lifetime again to go to still be show jumping.
Ah, yeah. Listen, so we're buying foals and breeding like mad, so I'll have to go for another 12 or 15 years anyway. It's like John, someone asked him last year or this year, how long more is he going to ride for? He says he just bought a new pair of boots, so he'll have to keep going a bit longer.
Right, we have a tradition on this podcast of asking what has annoyed you this week. Would you like to go first, or would you like us to go first?
Oh, well, you go first, and then I can get a bit more inspiration.
Yeah, you'll have loads of time to think about it, Michael, because she goes on.
Do you want to go first, Simon?
I don't know. Ballot dates for events have annoyed me.
Why have ballot dates?
Just because I miss them all the time.
Oh.
I miss them all the time. On a ballot day, you have to get your entries in by midday on the ballot day. And so many times, I'll be trotting around in the school and I'll go, oh no, I should have entered something today. And I'll look at my watch and be like, it's 5 to 12 or 5 past 12. One or the other.
And do they give you any grace because you're famous Simon Grieve? Not only you're a venter, but you're an influencer. Do they go, do you know what? We'll let him in.
Definitely not. Yeah, I'm very good at missing things like that.
Is there no comeback if you have actually missed it? Do you just have to go, fuck, I can't do that.
You just have to hope that they haven't been inundated with people and they've got a ballot. Because if there's a ballot, then you definitely won't get in.
You're definitely not getting in.
And maybe, hopefully, you might get put onto a wait list.
Aww.
Right, yeah. So yeah, they're really annoying. They've annoyed me this week.
That means if they've annoyed you, you've missed a few. That's why.
No, just very nearly missed.
Okay. What's annoyed me this week? My children and other people's children. So my son...
This isn't the first time, Jenny. This isn't the first time.
Which one? My children or other people's?
Your children. In fact, both.
Yes. No. Which should I go first? My child or someone else's? Because they're never going to...
Let's go with yours.
Okay, my children. So my son, who you've met, my son, he is a gorgeous, beautiful human being. And if you put him near some animals or a horse or anything, he is calm. He is zen. He will sit for 4 hours holding like a lizard or something or a snake, or he'll watch orcas for hours. Like if we go whale watching, he will wait 5 hours in the hopes he might see one. He won't get bored. If there's no animals or television involved, he is like a fucking... like whirlwind. He's like a man who's just come back from a stag doing bloody Benidorm. He is nuts. And he drives me fucking mental. And it's like, when he's being nuts, it's like, you can say his name 100 times, James. 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 And he just can't hear it. And he started now, when I do get his attention, and he's 8, and this has already started, he started doing this. Like this morning, I was like, did you clean your teeth as he came downstairs? And he went, oh. I was like, what the fuck? It's like Kevin and Perry. Do you remember that program?
It's just the start.
Oh my God. It was like me yesterday when I was hungover. That was the noise I was making. And, right, if he catches me swearing, he can fine me. If I say the F word, he can fine me $5. Any other word is like a dollar. I have never dropped the C-bomb, can I just say? So he gets very happy if he catches me. But the alternative to that, if I catch him swearing, he gets fined. So you can't even make my children swear. Like you can say to them, spell it. And they go, well, I get fined. And you're like, spell it and find out. And they won't. So they won't swear. But he loves to catch me swearing. So when he's not listening and I'm like, James, 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 I can do one of two things to get his attention. I can either open a packet of crisps. You've never seen a child move so quickly in your life. Like I could open it the other side of the fucking room and he'll hear that, but he won't hear his name. Or I can be like, James, James, fuck, you owe me $5. I'm like, how do you hear that but not your actual name? And I'm not, I love him with every part of my soul, but fuck my life. How do I have to cope with how many years of this? Like your so boy.
Basically, he's crafty and it's only going to get worse.
Oh my God. Where has that come from? He's 8. I thought that happened when you were like 14. Anyway, I feel better. I feel like I got that off my chest.
He's spent too much time with you. That's why.
Well, and then the other thing that's annoyed me, sorry, Michael. Michael's like, I should be jumping horses, not listening to this shit, is... my son being the cutest human on earth, he was at school and he was writing on a love heart, I love you, mummy, and he was making it for me to give to me. And some other little found it, held it up in front of all the boys in the class and was like, who do you love? And picked on him. So then all the boys bullied him. And so James threw it in the bin because he was so embarrassed. And then when I found him at school, he was like sobbing with tears because then he went to go and get it out of the bin when no one was watching and it wasn't there. And the said child, when I turned up at school to pick James up, when I turned up, I saw James and I saw suddenly this child sprint. You've never seen a child move so fast in your life. And I was like, I'm wondering why certain child is running away from me across the play park. And then James met me crying and told me that this child had bullied him. And I was like, aha, that's why. So the kid knew he'd done wrong.
Explain it.
So that's what's annoyed me. My own child and then other people's children.
What are you going to do about that then? I suppose it's difficult, isn't it, when you're parenting?
I'll just leave another child to it. It's just, yeah, it's coming. He's such a little douchebag. Someone's not going to tolerate his shit and he's going to get ended by someone.
It's just you saying he's such a little douchebag. I want to say.
Karma will get that child. I don't have to. I'm going to get in so much trouble for this. I should start slagging off corgis again. That'll get me in less trouble. Anyway, sorry. Michael Duffy, our lovely guest. Tell us what's annoyed you this week.
Oh, I have a couple of things this week.
Oh, yes.
One of them is my own fault. Delayed flights is, I was 4 hours in Nice Airport, but that seems to be every bloody week now. And missing cheek pieces. I'd be looking at a bridle and I'll go, ooh, I might put a gag on him. And I put the cheek piece down somewhere. And then you come back 2 days later when that didn't work. And I've got, I think I must have 20 half bridles now. And missing bits or stirrup leathers. I'm a disaster for that. I've mixed match and set up at the minute.
How much does your yard hate you then? You're like grooms and stuff. Do they just get really
angry?
Oh, then
I come in and blame them anyway. So where'd you put them cheek pieces? So, yeah. Yeah, or I put something down, like those Spurs, I put them in that tech locker and then they're not at the show and then I'd be like, where are they? Well, you left them at home. Well, right here. That's featherhead here.
I've not got to come back on that.
Yeah.
What's the worst thing you've ever forgotten at a show? Because Simon forgot his hat once and he's got a massive head and he can't just buy any hat or borrow a hat. Like,
I've never forgotten it, but it's the thing that I cannot forget.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
I forgot my top hat. When you wore top hats for dressage, and I tried to borrow one, and literally no one would fit me because I've got the biggest head in the entire universe.
Yeah, I don't remember forgetting anything. I remember my luggage got lost in Miami this year because, again, flight delayed, cancelled. So then I had to get a new flight the next morning in Newark, and baggage never arrived. So I had Stephen Moore's riding jacket and Derek Kenny's boots and Mikey Pender's jodhpurs, and I had my own little hand luggage. So I had. A toothbrush and underwear, but I didn't have anything else, basically.
Couldn't you, in those situations, when you're ever at a show with the other Duffy, be like, no, this was my bag, sorry. But he's probably shorter than you, though, isn't he?
Yeah, that's what I should have done, actually, yeah. if he's at a better show, going to the office. actually, funny, someone said to me, and I had Derek Kenny's boots on, they says, oh, you've got big boots to fill. I said, to be honest, I feel a bit small.
Yes! I love that.
I had a friend of mine who's probably won't mention the name, very good show jumper, went to a show a few weeks ago. They were going down to Chard, I think, so it's like, I don't know, it's like 4 hours or something like that from us. Anyway, so early in the morning, put the horses on the lorry. She didn't think much about it because she had somebody helping her that doesn't normally help her. They put the horse on the lorry, then she drove down there, and the girl at home rang her up and said, the horse you're supposed to be taking is still here. They'd taken the wrong horse. Yeah. So she went all the way down to Chard with the wrong horse. At least I think it was Chard.
That's amazing. I don't know how show jumpers keep up with the horses going in all directions and different countries. I don't know how you keep up with it.
It just sort of happens. I just get to the show and normally the right one is there. there's someone else doing it anyway. That's all I know.
We've established Margot has a seriously good team behind him.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Right. Michael Duffy, I have one final question for you. If you could talk to 12-year-old you, what would you tell him? And would he be amazed that you were traveling the world? And literally, you've listed off about 40 countries just in this interview of where you've been the last year. Or would he know that this was where he was destined to be? What would 12-year-old you think of you right now?
I suppose, honestly, I'd say I was always very, very hopeful anyway I was going to do it. You know, I always sort of knew, you know, if you did the right things, it would happen, you know. So what would I tell him? Yeah, shut up and get on with it. Keep going.
He knew it was going to happen, basically.
I like that. Because you do live an extraordinary life. the amount of countries you go to. It is nuts.
Ah, yeah, sure, it's great, isn't it? But you're, you know, to a normal person, they'd say you're mad, you know what I mean? But sure, I wouldn't swap anyway, that's for sure.
No, you just got back from Saint-Tropez. But you don't actually get that much time to enjoy it. I think we did enjoy the swimming pool in the Monaco Hotel, the one with the sand.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There's been a few good parties in the evening as well. Yeah, you take your wins when you get them.
Yeah, there has been that. Yeah, so this is why I got in trouble, because Shane won the Monaco Grand Prix when I was working, and we were jumping around, hugging, very excited, and we were trying to get a selfie of me and Michael, but with Shane in the background. And didn't realise, and I'd done my interview with him and it was over, but we didn't realise the cameras were still on them. So there's me holding the microphone trying to get a selfie, and the camera had gone wide, so you could see me and Duffy like prattling around. Yeah, my bosses had a little bit of a word with me. Could you wait until the cameras are off before you start taking selfies?
Whoopsie.
That was a big moment. I think you were just as excited as if you'd won it yourself. It was such a big moment for Shane.
Yeah, 100%. Well, again, he was a long time waiting for it, wasn't he?
Yeah, very long time, but well deserved. And then I got to ride that horse, Ipswich, later on that year. That was very fun. Anyway, we could talk all night, but we won't. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You'll have to get you back.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Yeah, you got to.
After you win an Olympic gold medal.
Well, that would be nice, yeah. we'll have to wait a couple of years for that.
you better invite me to that party. That would be a good one. Right. Simon, it's always lovely to see you.
Nice to see you too. Thanks very much, Michael, for joining us.
You've gone through a whole podcast, Simon, without saying you're tired. I'm so proud.
No, I'm not tired. I'm really tired.
Okay, there we go. That feels better. We have missed Benji, but thank you so much for joining us, Michael Duffy. All that is left to say is, what was you? Shut up and get on with it. But really, it's shut up and ride.
Exactly, yeah. Same thing. We should have patented that, shouldn't we?
We'll put it on a t-shirt. People can buy it.
Merchandise.